Welcome to Agam the Climate Podcast, a literary podcast on climate and consciousness. As we grapple with new uncertainties, we bring you the voices of poets, artists, and scientists who find solace and strength in the imagination. I'm Padma Perez for the Agam Agenda. Join me as we reimagine the climate crisis through stories and art. In this episode, we speak with writer, naturalist, teacher, and activist Yuvan Aves, based in Chennai, India. After quitting conventional schooling at the age of 16, Yuvan cultivated a deep relationship with the landscape around him. We have a rich conversation on what being a self-educated naturalist means to him. He shares stories about water wisdom, trust between humans and birds, and how language and art help to sow kinder futures for the planet. We also probe his online presence and how he uses social media for his writings, photos, and activism.
Hi, Yuvan. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, Padma.
Thank you for being here and making time for this. And we are speaking now. I'm in Pasay and you are in Chennai in India, right? And how is it there? What season are you in at this time of year? Is it hot or cold?
So we are actually segging into an early summer. It's unusually hot here. And I think it's a very relevant time to have the conversation we are having. There's a huge historic farmers protest going on in northern India. So these farmers have been sitting there for months protesting against three farmer bills which will completely put the agricultural sector into private hands, the Adani and the Ambani and so forth. And local farmers from all across India are sitting in the national capital protesting peacefully, and today this happened.
We face similar challenges with laws that don't really serve the interests of the people, or policies that are going to increase poverty rather and dispossession rather than change that situation. So to me and to us at Agam, you're a naturalist, you're a writer, a poet, you're a teacher as well, and you're a campaigner. But we've also come to know you as a contributor to the forthcoming international anthology. And I wanted to start by asking you about that. Could you describe to our listeners the image that you received or the writing prompt that you got from us?
I mean, it was a beautiful contemplative black and white picture of, I think, a cabin in the woods with a little window looking out onto a lake and then the hills in the distance. And that immediately took me back to the rural landscape of Tamil Nadu. It's entirely defined by its hydrology, a hydrology not entirely natural, but then in alignment with natural processes. And I've spent a lot of time sitting like that. One individual sitting on top of that cabin, and through that window, you can see his or her legs. So for many, many hours, I could have been that individual sitting on the bunds of a lake and looking on to the water.
So what was your experience of responding to that photo? How did it lead you to write what you wrote?
You know, the process was, you know, let me start here. I decided to educate myself. I moved out of conventional schooling when I was 16. So I came away from home and I wanted to learn by myself. I didn't want to be in an institution of learning. So I moved to this place called Patashala, where my mentor at the time, G. Gautama, he was heading that school. And it is a beautiful 100-acre campus in rural Kanchipuram in Tamil Nadu. And I enrolled for my A-levels. I scheduled my study time. I would pick up the phone and call up teachers if I had doubts. But a lot of my high schooling and later on was walking this landscape and conversations. I learned much more from conversations with villagers, farmers, children, colleagues, teachers, guests, far more than textbooks. And perhaps that's true of anybody, I think. And I understood this landscape from a ground up way by walking through it and speaking and watching and observing and understanding threats and issues related to it. So I think naturally that scene took me back there.
And you wrote a piece that you entitled Water Wisdom or Nir Jnanam. Could you tell us what this water wisdom is?
So Nir Jnanam. So Jnanam can be wisdom, can be insight, can be something you're born with, which is unique. The way it's used, it can be interpreted in so many ways. It's a beautiful word in Tamil. And if you look at Tamil Nadu and the surrounding regions, the eastern plains of peninsular India, it gets its rains for a short part of the year, for about 3 months. Ferocious, dense rains, and then rest of the time, it is largely dry. And all its rivers, so for instance, I live in Chennai, we have 3 rivers flowing here. Cities form around rivers. So we have the Adyar, Kuvam, and the Kosasthalaya. All of them are seasonal in nature. So the people here had a way of working with the land as such to have a way of conserving water so that it could sustain them for the entire year. So the technology as such they came up with was something called the Yeri system. So Yeri means lake, but not quite. So Yeri is a word which one cannot describe in English. Yeri is a water reservoir with bunds on 3 sides. And on one side, it slowly slopes into a catchment area, which is either looking onto a river basin or catching the overflow of a larger reservoir. So the Yeri system is actually a wetland system created by farmers, actually, to store water, make space for it to settle, and also make space for it to flow and then allow for sustenance and agriculture to happen. And this wisdom is kind of going away. And people then knew that this was the only way to live here, to make space for it to stay and make way for it to flow for water. And in different ways, starting from colonization, for instance, when the British came in, they had a very intelligent way of taking over people, making them laborers, enslaving them. They just destroyed the water reservoirs. So water was really, you know, in Adivasis of India, they have an ecology of self-reliance. They call it Jal, Jungle, Jameen. So which is water, land, and forest. These three were the only things required for self-reliance, not the kind of self-reliance that big governments talk about. Yeah, so my piece was rooted in that.
It's quite ancient, is it not, what you describe, the way that the water reservoirs were created? How far back in time did that practice go?
Yeah, so there are edicts, for instance, in Kadapa district, Andhra Pradesh, adjoining state of Tamil Nadu, dating back to the 12th century on how to build a yeri and the science behind it, how you kind of landscape to create that hydrology. But a lot of people who have studied this say it's far back. The water bodies itself are very, very a kind of deep time reservoirs. They are many, many centuries old.
That's amazing. And I like that you say that it was a whole hydrology and it was a whole landscape. So I would imagine that certain trees had to be planted because of qualities that they brought into the ecosystem or to the water reservoirs. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah. So it's interesting how when structures emerge from working with the land, working with the soil itself, when processes, you know, Tim Ingold says, making is knowledge. And when it emerges from the bottom, these water bodies were actually junctions in a reciprocity between people and ecology, people and birds, people and this landscape. So a lot of bird sanctuaries, for instance, something I wrote about is Vedandangal. A lot of other bird sanctuaries are yeris where people made them conducive for birds to come and nest, made them heronries by planting Barringtonia and other kinds of water tolerant species with broad canopies, so that when birds came and nested here, when their droppings, their guano fell into the water, and they were used to irrigate the fields, the yield was extraordinary. And birds then over centuries came to trust these spaces and came here to nest in their tens of thousands.
That's so interesting. But I saw in the early days of lockdown that Petatangkal was under threat because it was going to be delisted as a reserve. What's happening to that now?
So Petatangkal is the oldest bird sanctuary in India. And what is very, very special about it is that it's a community conserved place. You know, there's some very interesting literature I read recently about how declaring of protected spaces is sometimes a strategy in displacing people, in warring with local communities. Petatangkal is not such a place. So about three centuries ago, the local people, so Petatangkal, Vedan means hunter. So in one translation of the word, it means hunter's paradise because you could go there and shoot a lot of birds. But then the farmers here, at the time, L. Place was the collector of that district. They got a little letter from him saying that they are allowed to protect that place and ban hunting there. And then they got another form of protection, became a reserve forest. And then in the 1990s, it became a wildlife sanctuary. At every stage of which the community pushed for its protection, because they had a centuries-old relationship with the pelicans and ibises and herons. This is something unheard of. You walk into other places, let's say you see painted stocks and open-bill stocks, they will fly away at a very far distance if they see you. You go into Petatangkal, the trust is palpable. At a reaching distance, they'll be nesting with their chicks. And that's a trust which is built over centuries. So what happened here, you know, with fading local practices and urbanization and all that which follows, three illegal industries came to function inside the wildlife sanctuaries. It's prohibited under law. And what the government wanted to do is shrink 60% of the sanctuary so that all these industries will fall outside and then kind of become legalized and also allow for commercialization outside. So we protested. Petatangkal, in a sense, is a pride of Tamil Nadu because of its landscape and its status. So we had all forms of protest, social media, on the ground. We had a whole lot of films released. And right now, everybody's gone quiet because in another 3 months, elections are coming. And they don't want to pick it up because of the kind of public outcry which came out for it. But then we are trying to push for the opposition parties to include things like these in their manifestos and kind of make it part of the politics of electoral politics. So that, you know, it's not forgotten.
What's your experience of social media as a platform for the work that you do?
In some senses, it can really amplify what you're fighting for. You can get a couple of thousand emails sent and put the pressure or even twist the decision which is going to be made somewhere. While also the decision makers usually are far more powerful on social media. So then that is there as well. But before one comes to social media, I think there's a lot of invisible hard work which needs to be done in activism. You know, reading the reports, the various documents, the laws, making site visits, and talking to people, understanding the whatever you're campaigning for in extraordinary depth, in all its perspectives. And then you come to social media, that it pays you, it serves you. So that's how it works. So social media really works like, you know, these little, I don't know, tip of the icebergs. I like to call them mangrove roots. You know, these mangrove roots, they have different kinds of roots, but then they stick out so that they can breathe when the tide comes in. But then a lot of their roots are under the ground. So
that's a much better metaphor for us, I think, than icebergs. You're right. We should start using that and getting more people to use the mangrove metaphor. It's just the mangrove roots.
In so many ways, mangroves also build coastlines.
Yes.
Yeah, because they have these snorkel roots and then they trap soil and falling vegetation and the new seedlings form there. And over a period of time, they actually build and stabilize coasts. And in so many ways, they're a fantastic metaphor.
Amazing. So what I got from what you said is really what we see on social media is a lot of work distilled to a few sentences, right? I like that perspective because often people criticize online activism as clicktivism, where people think you just click and you've done something. But I appreciate how you emphasize that before you write that post on social media, a lot of research and a lot of networking and discussion goes on, and there's real work that happens behind it. So actually the work precedes the social media rather than, you know, the premise that yes, we're on social media, but you need to do the real work. I like how you reversed that. It's interesting also, a lot of your writing on Instagram especially is about nature and the natural world and what we can see of it in our immediate surroundings. Do you feel that social media has been conducive to drawing that attention to the natural world?
Well, in my experience, I think I've met some extraordinary people, Agam itself, through the work one does through social media. I think it's the spirit and the energy. It can be social media, it can be print media, it can be something, you know, what the energy one brings to that platform. One needs to look through the medium into that field. And I try to ground myself in that. But this place can be a very distracting space, you know, to kind of click and get addicted. But it's not so much the medium. The medium is good and bad and beautiful and ugly in its own ways. But it's been very useful for me and my work, and to network and to meet people and have different kinds of conversations.
And it's true. That's how we met and how we felt we wanted to invite you to participate in what Agam was doing, because we loved what you were doing on Instagram. And it's funny, that's how our connection started. But what really drew us to your work was your nature writing. And I think this goes back to what you shared earlier of how you educated yourself. You took control of your education from when you were 16 and spent much of that time walking through a landscape. How did that lead into your becoming a naturalist and writing a lot about nature?
You know, when we use the word naturalist, it actually conventionally means that it's a kind of a profession where you take people around and kind of tell them, show them the birds and the insects and the trees. And you're like a tour guide. But then for me, you know, very young, I studied in a very formative school for me. It was under the Krishnamurti Foundation. Even later, the campus I was part of, I was self-educating myself. But then the atmosphere was that of a philosopher called J. Krishnamurti, who said, truth is a pathless land. No religion or spirituality organization can lead you to it. You have to be a light onto yourself. It was very difficult to find a philosophy which sets you free. And at one point, he happened to say, these are my teachings. Tear them to shreds. Be a light onto yourself. And one experienced that space and freedom. There was space to question. And he was one of the few people who told teachers, say, get off the pedestal. You're not higher than the children. I experience schooling as a horizontal space, and I think that led to a lot of my growth. You know, often the metaphor used for education and learning is that of a ladder, is that of hierarchy. But then something else happens to the human being when there is an experience of a horizontal field in learning. So very early on, I read Krishnamurti, and he would speak a lot about nature. And then I read writers like M. Krishnan, Indian writer, Annie Dillard, Robert McFarlane, people like Gary Zukav, Aldo Leopold. You know, for them, nature and the way they call them naturalists was a metaphor, in it, not an occupation as such. Because being a naturalist meant standing up for the earth. You know, being a naturalist meant having the courage to question powers. It meant being part of a countercurrent to hegemonic colonial practices. in my teens, this is what being a naturalist meant. Very early, I wanted to call myself a naturalist. I mean, I might know a little bit about birds and trees and insects, but not really out of knowledge, but because what it meant as your set of values in life and what you're grounded in. So that's what being a naturalist means to me. And often, sometimes I call myself a pseudo-naturalist because sometimes I meet people, colleagues and friends who are extraordinarily knowledgeable. They can walk through a place and because that's their profession. You know, they can read the tracks and they can smell and see so much more and hear. And that's not where I am. So, yeah.
I'm surprised to hear that, Yuvan, because to me, when I read your work, I feel like I know so little about my own surroundings. And in some way, reading your work has also inspired me to pay closer attention to what's immediately around me. I may be living in the big bad city, but there are trees outside and there are birds that I hear every day. So I've learned a little bit about my neighbors. So you have a regular practice of documenting and sharing words that point to nature, to community, to the more than human. How far back does this practice go for you?
This was actually after, you know, two people largely influenced this. And the space I lived in, the words which came into my head, but I was not conscious of the power of these words and what they created and what their vanishing would imply. And so one person, of course, was Robert McFarlane, his book Landmarks, and his Twitter word of the day, which he has stopped for some reason. And it used to be my daily ritual to go and read that word. And then another extraordinary, perhaps India's greatest linguist, G.N. Devi, who conducted in its structure, the world's largest people's linguistic survey. So, you know, the way the Indian government does the linguistic survey, it defines what the languages are, it divides the states linguistically. And he talks about how between one decade to another, it had actually vanquished about 1,200 languages because there were Adivasi languages. Not recognizing languages was a political strategy and so on. So his work was really, he walked from village to village collecting folklore, songs, stories, lexicon. And these people's works really was the grounding inspiration for this. Of course, in no way kind of comparable to what they've done and are doing, but
inspired by that.
Yeah.
And what's the power in these words that you're finding as you do this?
So there are a lot of stories to be shared. For instance, one story from India. I've spoken about Tamil Nadu already. I'll maybe take a story from the Northeast. You know, we earlier spoke about how you mentioned how the government has a lens of looking at people and place and interpreting it, while the ground reality is something else. There's a tribe called the Idu Mishmi who live in Arunachal Pradesh, dense rainforest in Northeast India. And in their Genesis story, you know, Genesis stories have extraordinary power in shaping one's culture and worldview. There's this beautiful essay by Lynn White called The Historical Roots to Our Ecological Crisis. And he talks about the Genesis story of one of our major religions, which said, you know, all the creatures of the world are created for man to exploit in that sense. So for the Idu Mishmi, the Genesis story was the first Idu person was second born to the gods. The first born was the tiger. And the tiger is the elder brother for them. And very interestingly, where they live in the Dibang Valley in Arunachal Pradesh, there are more tigers found in the community forest than in the wildlife sanctuary because of the centuries old kind of coexistence with a top predator is kind of unheard of. It's absolutely, you read that story, it's extraordinary. I mean, another, just one more story which has moved me very deeply. This is from the Hawaiian coast, the Zolon Salinan tribe. I'm sure I'm pronouncing it incorrectly. They have this indigenous writer, Deborah Utasia Cole, writes about how the Honu, which is the local word for the green sea turtle, It is supposed to be in their folklore, the protector of children, the guide to fishermen, and so on. And when the colonial powers came in, they banned the local language. And because the totemization of the turtle went away, they almost went towards extinction. And later there was a reviving movement of the language into schools, etc. And when the language came back, it fueled conservation efforts. And then the green sea turtle was brought back. The language, you know, that's a very powerful story. And you have examples of that everywhere. There's language, landscape, reciprocity, where one protects the other, in fact.
That's amazing. You know, we talk a lot about language, and often it's in how do we make something understandable? Like, how do we use language to make, for example, climate change understandable? But again, you've shown us another perspective. You've flipped it around again and said, how can language be in a reciprocal relationship with the landscape or with our environment? And I think that's something for writers to think about, because the tools of a writer are words and language. We use language. So how do we use that language to create that reciprocity as well? That's a puzzle and a challenge right there.
Not to kind of normalize language entirely. Language has this power. It can carry in itself the power to protect, dignify, vividify, you know, people, life, living systems, but also the opposite. For instance, the caste system in India, it's written in a book called Manusmriti, and it's there for 2,500 years, completely obsolete, but then held very strongly and violently in so many places, especially with the current ruling party in power, is carried through language. So, yeah, not to kind of completely, romanticize
right.
how language works, you know, yeah.
Which is all the more reason why the use of language has to be more deliberate, I think. What are your thoughts on how to nurture a connection with the natural world and bring that into our work as writers?
Well, what immediately comes to mind is words of this writer called Philip Shepard, and he talks about something called embodied activism. And how the disconnect with our body and the disconnect with the earth are kind of synonymous. You know, the first living natural thing we experience is the body. And we speak about environment being backdrop, a stage, you know, something that we are increasingly seeing not to be, you know, with the climate crisis and everything. It's exercising agency like anything. But in some sense, we also look at, you know, there's some philosophies and also urban living, and even our practice of science sometimes looks at the body and the senses as instrument, as backdrop, as something else, you know, and everything, all thinking and all is cerebral in a sense. Something I very strongly felt while in my practice of writing is that for my deep well-being, you know, the feeling of happiness is moving feet. You know, a lot of my mind was in my feet. You know, if feet did not move, I couldn't think as such. You know, but then scientifically, you don't find a piece of the brain in the foot. But that was reality. That is one part of it. The other part of it is you take a child, 3-year-old, 7-year-old, even 10-year-old, go into a park, a grassland, a forest, and she or he is wilderness naturally. You know, I came into education very early. You know, from 16, I've been part of conducting science workshops, you know, interacting with children. For many years, I've been doing that. I've not met a single child. I've interacted with hundreds of children. A single young child who's not enraptured by wilderness, by the natural world, in their own terms. You know, it could be watching, it could be, you know, looking under the leaves, it could be playing with the sand, it could be running. But then somewhere, you know, there is a kind of growth which happens. You know, a writer friend of mine calls grown-ups, you know, GROANUPS, you know, because there's a kind of degrowing which happens after, you know, you move out of childhood and adolescence.
It sounds to me like we and many poets have said this before, we need to hold on to that childlike way of taking delight in what's immediately before us. We don't have to go far from where we are to be delighted by the world, right?
And delight, the way we speak about delight, of wonder, of curiosity, you know, John Holt, an extraordinary educator, spoke about this. They rise from real concerns and real needs, grounded in the actuality of the environment. We speak of these feelings as kind of airy fairy, you know, beautiful things, which then cannot be really accommodated, you know, once you grow up and then you have, you know, life banging on your doors. But then wonder and curiosity grows out of real questions, real concerns, needs. And that is the connection we don't see in childhood. A child comes up with a question. It's deeply rooted.
I want to go back now to what's happening on the ground again. And more recently, you've been involved again in the campaign to save Pulicat Lake. Could you describe Pulicat to our listeners, please?
Yeah. So Chennai was divided into south and north by the British. And the south, the bureaucrats and the other kinds of landlords and other people live. And the north, the tribes and the fisherfolk and the people, farmers, people who lived off the land lived. You know, it's actually a beautiful bioregion. Three rivers flow through there. And then it's a mosaic of habitats. There's tropical dry evergreen forest. There is scrubland, coastal dunes, sand barrier island, mudflats, salt pans. You can drive or walk through that place and come across, you know, 5, 6, 10 different habitats and life forms and so on. And so these rivers flow into Pulicat Lagoon, which is a huge brackish water body protected from the sea by thin barrier islands. Barrier islands are made of sand. And if you actually go and shift through time in Google Earth, these sand barrier islands kind of snake in time because they're not rocks. You know, they are molded and shifted by wave action. Is that fragile thing holding that entire ecosystem in place. Unfortunately, you know, I like to bring in this word into common use to kind of tarnish the sheen on the word development. I want to call it discriminatory development. Because then where you propose a project, you have to ask the questions, who lives there? You know, do they have political power? Will their voice matter? And so on. And often you find decisions are made not because of the appropriateness of a project to the site, but because of discriminatory reasons. So all the dirty industries in Chennai, the first port, the first thermal power stations, the petrochemical industries, the pharma industries, the fertilizer industries, all like highly polluting industries came in North Chennai because you could silence the voices of these people and because their voices was not heard. If you did the same in South Chennai, the people who live there with their wealth and say, they could put you out of power or business. So that is really the reality of this ecosystem. It's rich in its cultural and ecological realities, but it's also can be a dark and ugly place. The British called it the Black Town, in fact.
Why did they call it the Black Town?
Because of the people who lived there. So it was fisherfolk, it was farmers, and so on. And what they did was also, they brought in a lot of bonded labor to work in these industries. One thing, it was color of skin. Other thing, it was what you considered a respectful livelihood, what they considered. And the kind of livelihoods they could take advantage of, they could kind of wash away. And also wanted to stop so that the colonization could take place. So that word is a complex word. And racist in all kinds of ways.
Yeah. And why is Pulicat threatened today?
You know, coasts behave very interestingly compared to other landscapes. Different landscapes have their idiosyncrasies. But then if you have a forest, then the people living in a forest, dependent on a forest, and then you have a project coming there, unless you're living inside the site of the project, you're kind of safe. But coasts are different. You know, there's something called longshore currents, which are very, very formative and powerful on the Indian coast. So if you build something on the coast, you block the flow of the longshore currents. So on the eastern coast of India, it flows from south to north. And if you block it, the sand accretion in the south and the north, sand is not coming. So sand is taken away and the sea comes in. So that has happened like anything already along these coasts. And huge villages which existed, hectares of land which were once there, not there, because the sea has taken them. And you build inside the sea will take things back. It is very kind of categorical about that. It exercises that power. And very strongly here, because we live on the coast of the Bay of Bengal, there are two seas which are most unpredictable and stormy and turbid. One is the Bay of Bengal, other is the Caribbean Sea. You can't predict when it will spew out a cyclone. So this port, which is about 6,000 acres, 3,000 of which will be jutting into the seas, is 2.1 kilometers from the Pulicat Lagoon and Bird Sanctuary. So this comes about here. These currents will wipe out the sand barrier islands and the sea will take over the Pulicat Lagoon and that entire place will be flooded. And very interestingly and importantly, this is something which will affect lakhs of people who are living there. Lakhs in India is hundreds of thousands. You know, 100,000 is a lakh, we say. But also Pulicat is also our first sentinel during the northeast monsoon. When cyclones come into Chennai, the mangrove systems of Pulicat actually buffer its force. It is the city's largest flood catchment. We are facing floods, worse floods every time because our wetlands, our water bodies, we are constructing upon them. So it's something the entire city is worried about. And we also get much of one-fourth of our groundwater from there. And if the port would trigger saltwater intrusion into these aquifers, then we would lose drinking water. Drinking water is, again, something we are very scarce in here. So this reality and this narrative has been able to garner public outcry from across Chennai and Tamil Nadu, something people did not rise up to stand for earlier.
So a port is going to be built which will affect, well, it sounds like the entire city, not just Pulicat Lake, but Pulicat Lake is the important site that needs to be protected. And what do you think galvanized people to stand up now and speak out and protect Pulicat?
So one very powerful, you know, strategy in campaigns, which I've been part of observing, is artistic expression, whatever form that might take. You know, art in its most broadest, widest, meaning. What it does is, let's say 10 years ago, if I wanted to be in a campaign, I had to be an adult. I had to have some knowledge of the thing and I had to be respected and so on and so forth. You know, the Vedandangal campaign, a four-year-old drew a beautiful picture and that we got published and it moved people in whatever way it did. But she had a say, a four-year-old, in any other campaign space, how can a four-year-old make her voice heard? And art kind of opened up campaign spaces. You know, its ground-upedness as well as its democratizing of what a campaign can be like. So schools could participate. There was an inter-school-wide campaign across Chennai, making art, creating an endorsement letter, which was sent to various authorities. And this drew a lot of attention. And the opposition parties, you know, it became a political thing. The ruling party is doing this and that has its own slant, but it was useful. And interesting thing, during a press conference, we displayed all the art. And the fisher people, one old lady who's actually locally spearheading the fisher folks movement against it.
In Pulicat.
In Pulicat. So there is a small port called LNT, 330 acres, which will be expanded into 6,000 plus acres. When that was being built, her people were kind of brutally thrown out of there. And then because of this port, that's going to happen again. And the kind of solidarity children gave, she said, when you were thrown out the first time, none of you blinked an eye. And to see this now, it empowers us. We will fight with renewed energy. That's the kind of solidarity. You know, if there is solidarity, then the local people find means and the energy to push and fight in very powerful ways. Sometimes you just need that. You need to know you're backed.
That's a beautiful story. And did the art also have an impact on the decision makers?
Yeah. So what has currently happened right now is that there was a public hearing. Public hearing in any EIA is where people with any plausible concern or stakeholders can come and say what they think about the project. And then various role holders will have to listen to that and record it and take it into account. That has been postponed, citing COVID reasons and citing too many people are expected. So we had a big campaign. Part of the call to action of the campaign was that, hey, show up for the public hearing. So they expected, you know, thousands of people to come there in that little hall they had booked. So that has been postponed and that will not happen till May, till the elections are over. And what happens when you do that, when you postpone projects, is that the funders of the project proponent get jittery and they start getting doubtful and you have more time to strategize and fight.
Good luck. Good luck. I love how children have been able to participate in this campaign and also in the Veda Tanggal campaign. So this brings me now to your commitment to children's education and our children's relationships with the natural world.
When I was in class 10, maybe 8, 9, 10 years ago, environmental education was compulsory. You know, that subject was like English. You know, you had to take it.
Wow.
And then it was kicked out. And then it was an optional thing. But nobody would take it because it did not have a kind of occupational this thing to it. You know, you could study it and what. Very few took it, basically. And there is a categoric progressive cutting down of environmental education, which is happening from the government's perspective. But then beautifully, there are lots of alternative institutions, practices, the unschooling movement, the homeschooling movement, etc. And when they emerge, environment is naturally part of what is being taught. So yeah, there is this whole dynamic happening.
So why is it important to have that though?
So my work, you know, if I were to define what is my interest in education is to have to put the earth and the child at the center, you know, the center of education. You take a syllabus and you look through it and you ask, you know, what is your core intention? You know, what is your core value? Is it the child's well-being? And the core intention is to lift the spirit of the child and to blossom as she or he is born and feels good about herself. Is it that, you know, you get what I'm saying? Or is it something else? When you question the values of something, then you look deeper. So when you question that with syllabi, that's not it. They have agendas and they have a set of, market demands and whatever. And then children are looked at as raw material to be fashioned into products and then put on a conveyor belt and fitted into your machinery. So that is deeply colonial in the sense, and it's colonial very intrinsically. So what would education look like if I put the child's well-being at the center and the earth's well-being at the center? And very interestingly, both are synonymous at a very philosophical, metaphoric level, you know. And one of the things I've experienced is that a great protection you can give to a place is you take children there. I have conviction I have now because the way I experience Vedandamu is not just a nursery for birds, it's a nursery for children. You start your birding there. I've been there since I have flashes of that place from early childhood. I just remember the loud whoosh of wings overhead and the smell of guano from the water and the beak clatter and so on. And that's to bring back those values into education.
And you yourself have taken your students there.
Yeah, yeah.
Many of them.
Yeah.
And now with the climate crisis, we're seeing that it really is one and the same thing. To take care of the child's well-being, you also need to take care of the earth's well-being. It's astounding to think back on how we ever thought of those things as separate and then got our species and so many other species into trouble along the way. When you yourself think about climate change or the climate crisis, where does your mind or heart go? And where do you find yourself when you're thinking about it?
You know, the metaphor I've been holding close and thinking about a lot is being ground up. Because when a process, when a dialogue is ground up, land up, then the land can speak. You know, there is space for that. There is space for plurality. There's space for diversity. There's space for a lot of voices to be heard. There's space for place to be a polyglot, speak in many voices. And when that space is there, then the erstwhile voiceless have space to speak also. You know, the trees and the birds and in their own ways. And I think the climate crisis, in a very metaphoric sense, has to do with top-down structures. In governance systems, in education, in our corporate structures, and the lack of horizontal spaces. Horizontal not meaning flat. Horizontal spaces can be rugged. But then hierarchical systems, you know, one can look at how these spaces function in specificities. But then in a very general sense, I feel they have a lot to do with trashing the earth, hierarchies. And I think egality, in many senses, it's unnatural for something to be like that. If you look at natural ecosystems, it's along various planes. The most resilient ecosystems are diverse ones. And in hierarchies, diversities can't function. There's just monoculture. In whatever sense, you know, monoculture is one of the most greatest violences of our times, whether it be in farming or whether it be in how educational institutions try to frame a certain kind of intelligence as accepted. Jobs, what a good life means. There's a monoculture of that as well with vested interests. That's something I'm deeply thinking about right now. The structure of spaces and dialogue.
What about the space you presently occupy? I mean, your home, where you live, your surroundings. To me, it seems you pay attention to that every day and you see something and call our attention to it as well by posting about it and writing about it. Do you think about these things in relation to the climate crisis, and what are your thoughts?
I live in a very dense urban space, and something we have started off, and then a few of my students are kind of starting off in their own localities, anchoring it, are these urban wilderness walks. So it started with me, inviting children of my apartment. Actually, one night, my doorbell rang, and then about 8 children came to me with an injured crow, saying, "What do I do? This thing's on my doorstep." And I said, "No, leave it on top. The crows are social creatures, and the parents may be there." And then the next morning they come back again. "No, the parent hasn't taken, it's just standing there." And then that conversation led to me, for the interaction with the children, I took a bunch of about 25-30 parents and children on a walk, a little activity sheet, looking at things which is breaking out of the cement and asphalt and the cracks of the concrete, you know, how a certain kind of rewilding is happening. And that led to many kinds, many extrapolations of thinking. You know, one is engaging and looking at and enjoying biodiversity creates community and relationship with the earth and with each other in that context. It's both context and being as such. It's different people are now doing it in different spaces, and we are seeing where all it could be done and how moving slowly in urban spaces, you know, when you look at architecture, you it's important to question what it embodies, you know, what values it embodies. You take a road, what is it really saying? A highway through an expansive habitat. What it's really saying is land is mere distance to be crossed. The peripheries don't matter. You know, it's time delay. But then if one were to create a culture of walking in urban spaces, what would that mean? Now, there would be more trees, because if I walked, I want shade. There would be benches. There would be more conversations. There would be more parks, well-maintained. There would be more streetlights. There would be more public toilets. It would be a safer space for women, and so on and so forth. And then when the pace of cities increases, you see the entire opposite motion happening. Yeah, this is what I'm thinking about and engaging in right now in the space I'm sitting on.
It's how to create those relationships and how to enjoy biodiversity where you are in a city that's it's possible.
And also walk in a city is an act of resistance. You are slowing down its pace, perhaps in a minuscule way, but then you're still doing that. And cities are so unfavorable for walkers. It's hot. You can't sit. You don't have water. You don't have washrooms. You can't.
No sidewalks.
Yeah. There are sidewalks, but there are vehicles on that too.
Yeah.
So I think walking can be a big metaphor to subvert the culture in urban spaces and create a sense of belonging, because frantic pace erases belonging, and walking opens up, makes you vulnerable to the world around and your sensorium and the way you experience your environment. Moving slowly, whether it be walking or cycling or whatever it is.
I'll come now to a fun question. I know, Yuvan, that there are many more than human species in your life and that you could name many of them. Oh, speaking of naming, I want to ask you about that first. I think it's great to be able to name what you see, you know, for so many. Oh, look, it's a bird, you know, or look at this tree. But so many now are unable to say, look, it's a Philippine pied fantail, or look, it's a kingfisher, and what kingfisher in particular. What's the importance of being able to name something?
Naming is also a plural act. You know, something has always had many names, and modern science has its shortcomings and its lacunae to kind of universalize naming. You know, a local person will always know that when something has a lot of names, then its significance is so much more. Keystone species have dozens of names, and so on. There are different kinds of naming, but to call it something brings it into your consciousness and your conversations, and then it appears in your life. And then there is a chance for whatever that relationship is. And especially in today's day, there is a chance for conservation of that. In calling it a name, it could be protected. And love, build stories around, and so on. It's difficult to do that without a name. Maybe our brain works like that, to give it a defined location in our consciousness is a name, is the act of naming.
Yeah, wow, thank you. Thank you for that. And so now I'll ask you finally to name this more than human or non-human species that has a presence or has had a strong presence in your life.
Oh, well, there are a lot.
I thought so.
Every morning, right now, the streets have not got as busy as they could be maybe a few months ago. But what has happened is when the city quietened down and all the vehicles kind of parked, songbirds came back into the streets. You know, the thing about songbirds is that you can have their habitat intact, the water body or the forest or anything, but then if the sound space is not conserved, they vanish because they have to sing and they have to be heard. And theirs is a world hearing, more than a world view. And during COVID, the magpie robin came back. It's an improviser among birds. Improvisation, neuroscientists call it as the highest acts of creativity, to spontaneously make music. So magpie robin, what it does is it starts with a few notes, it kind of plays around with it. And then, you spend half an hour doing something else, you come back to the bird, and then it fashioned a whole song out of it. And the next day it's different. It sings a new song every day. And it's a very difficult bird initially to recognize by ear because its song is not the same. And you have to recognize it by its tonality, like how you recognize the timbre of a violin or a cello or a flute. So that is something right now on my mind.
Wonderful. So thank you for everything you've shared with us for this conversation, and so much food for thought, so much to think about. And also, I've heard so many invitations to practice certain ways of seeing and thinking and writing. So thank you, Yuvan, for your generosity and for everything you shared.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you for listening. AGAM, the Climate Podcast, is produced by the Institute for Climate and Sustainable Cities and Ground Bravo Studios, with music by Rohan Remando. Follow AGAM, the Climate Podcast on Spotify, Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about our creative collaborations and our forthcoming anthology of climate literature from the Global South, visit our website agam.ph. That's agam.ph. You can also engage with AGAM Agenda on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.